I'm Christopher Lydon with Damien Searles, the young story writer, translator, trendmaker. This time, he's digging up old gold and present-day power in maybe the greatest European poet of the 20th century, Rainer Maria Rilke. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Last time, Damien Searles, you brought Henry David Thoreau back alive in the journal of his lifetime. What brings us now to Rainer Maria Rilke, besides your wonderful book titled The Inner Sky?
Thanks, Chris. It's fun to be back and talking about someone who is so different, but since they're both so universal, they feel similar to me in a way. Thoreau was someone who explored everything about the world, and whether it was a patch of lichen on some tree bark or whether it was the stars in the sky, he would look into it and be aware of himself looking at the same time and find connections between every little particle of the natural world and everything about his spiritual life. Rilke is another writer who has that universality. He's more contemplative. He's more poetry. So what he does is he takes everything into this cauldron of his poetic being. And then what comes out is, as you say, some of the great poetry of the 20th century. For me, I always, up through college, thought of myself as someone who didn't really understand poetry. I think a lot of people are like that. I respected it. I sort of admired the special people who understood it. But I just thought, well, you know, it's not for me. And then I was waiting for someone, a friend of mine, in a library, and they had a display copy of a Rilke book called Selected Poetry, translated by Stephen Mitchell. And I happened to flip through it while I was waiting for my friend. And suddenly I saw what everyone had been talking about all these years. So I thought maybe I'd start with some of the poetry that first brought me to Rilke.
Please.
This is a poem called Autumn Day, and I'm going to read the translation by Stephen Mitchell. Lord, it is time. The huge summer has gone by. Now overlap the sundials with your shadows, and on the meadows let the wind go free. Command the fruits to swell on tree and vine. Grant them a few more warm, transparent days. Urge them on to fulfillment then, and press the final sweetness into the heavy wine. Whoever has no house now will never have one. Whoever is alone will stay alone. Will sit, read, write long letters through the evening, and wander on the boulevards up and down restlessly while the dry leaves are blowing.
Take it apart, Damien. Why do we gasp?
I think we gasp because the images are so simple and yet they have this resonance with you. You know, the huge summer. We've all lived through summers, but here it is, the huge one, and you sort of feel it. But it's over. There might still be a few warm days, but summer's gone. And then the punch of it at the end, whoever is alone will stay alone. So you have this feeling of abandonment because the summer, the huge summer has gone by, and you feel this loss. And then he's telling you, there you are. That's the emotion. That's the feeling that this poem first creates in you and then amplifies and sort of puts you into for good. And it doesn't stay at this sort of abstract level of you're alone. It goes back into the long letters through the evening and the dry leaves blowing. And so suddenly you're just in this different world that you hadn't been in before you started reading Autumn Day. Rilke makes these claims on you. He's someone who doesn't let you just turn the page and move on. Before you get to the end of whatever poem it is, he sort of brought you somewhere or brought out something that you have inside of you. And nothing else does that. that's what I sort of learned 20 years ago when I stumbled on this book as someone who didn't understand poetry, that it can do something that's different.
Give us another.
This is one of his great ones, and it's called Archaic Torso of Apollo. The speaker of the poem, Rilke, is in a museum. This is the Louvre. He's in Paris. It's the first decade of the 20th century. And he is looking at a classical fragment, a torso of Apollo. It's a sculpture, but it doesn't have a head. It doesn't have arms and legs. All it has is sort of shouldered down to thighs. And he is struck by the fact that this godlike work of art, even though it's missing so many things, is actually more complete than he is.
Hmm.
And so here's the poem. Archaic Torso of Apollo. We never knew his head and all the light that ripened in his fabled eyes, but his torso still glows like a candelabra in which his gazing, turned down low, holds fast and shines. Otherwise, the surge of the breast could not blind you, nor a smile run through the slight twist of the loins toward that center where procreation thrived. Otherwise, this stone would stand deformed and curt under the shoulder's invisible plunge, and not glisten just like wild beast's fur, and not burst forth from all its contours like a star, for there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life.
That last line is so famous, but also deeply mysterious to me. How does he get from the sexual vitality, the vision, the activity, the pulse of Apollo to that conclusion?
I think that one of his great topics and great sort of feelings is this sense that I think everyone in the modern world has of being small. And whether it's faced with God or whether it's faced with a great work of art or whether it's faced with a loved one or whatever it is, there's this question that we ask ourselves, you know, am I enough? Am I really up to the task that is being set for me by this greater force? And this is such a great poem about that because it's both art and this sort of classical god, Apollo, that is looking down at him. Even without a head, the shoulders and the chest can look down at him. Mm. There's no place that doesn't see you. Wherever you are in your life, you're being asked this question if you're open to it and if you're sensitive to it. So being told that in this incredibly simple and direct and vague way is a way that activates all those feelings you have of your own.
Damien, would you take us into your title, his line about the inner sky? He writes endlessly about inner and outer skies, spaces, awarenesses, God, man, the great melody out there and the individual voice. What is he telling us about spaces?
Well, like we were just talking about, we feel these responses to the world and to the greater forces. And it's sometimes hard to, if you really think about it, draw the line between where you end and the world begins or vice versa. I've been a reader of Rilke for 15, 20 years, but I never decided to translate him until I came across this poem. So I'm going to read this. This is the last poem in the book, The Inner Sky. This is translated by me. What birds hurtle through is not the familiar sky that raises form and shape within you. Out in the open, out there, you are denied to yourself and fade farther forever. Sky grabs out from us and translates things. That you might reach a tree in all its being, fling inner sky around it, from that sky that abides in you. Ring it with measure. It will not edge itself. Only the pressure in your renouncing makes it truly tree.
Mm. The sky that abides in you. What's that?
It's a cliche or a commonplace that everyone sees the world from a different perspective. And so the different perspective is a metaphor of angles, that if you're standing a little to the left, you'll see a slightly different surface of the tree or whatever it is you're looking at. And so he, in this poem, has a very different and much more mysterious and resonant image for everyone's different reality. What he says is that you have this universe inside of yourself, the inner sky. So when we are trying to perceive or interact with what's out there, what we do is we take this inner sky from inside ourselves and we throw it past the object in the world to form the background against which this tree is defined. So if you picture a tree sort of standing alone on a field with against the sky, the shape of the tree is defined against the background. But what that background is from us. So instead of saying that we're looking at the tree from a certain angle, he says we're looking at the tree against a certain background that we've defined. The tree will not edge itself. It's only us in this act of seeing it against a certain background that is what it really is. The whole idea of inner sky was actually the word that made me translate this book, because the dictionary definition of the German word is space, and all the previous translators have translated as inner space or space reaching out from us or things like that. But space is so science-y. Do you know what I mean? It's so abstract and mathematical. And if you hear about a space inside yourself, it just doesn't have the poetry. And so thinking about this poem and like, okay, well, what's the space that birds are flying around in? Well, it's a sky. Oh, it's a sky inside you. That translation decision to go with a more sort of imagistic, concrete word for this German word that means space is what made the poem come to life for me and what made the project of this whole book come together.
Damien, I think I'm getting it. Speaking of birds, would you just read the one paragraph prose note on birds? Because it plays with connected ideas, I think.
Yeah, so here it is, note on birds. I figured it out, something that was never clear to me before, how all of creation transposes itself out of the world, deeper and deeper into our inner world, and why birds cast such a spell on this path into us. The bird's nest is, in effect, an outer womb given by nature. The bird only furnishes it and covers it rather than containing the whole thing inside itself. As a result, birds are the animals whose feelings have a very special, intimate familiarity with the outer world. They know that they share with nature their innermost mystery. That is why the bird sings its songs into the world as though it were singing into its inner self. That's why we take a bird song into our inner selves so easily. Mm. It seems to us that we translate it fully, with no remainder, into our feelings. A bird song can even for a moment make the whole world into a sky within us, because we feel that the bird does not distinguish between its heart and the world's.
Mm. So many ideas, so many leaps of notions. It's hard to say what currency he's dealing in, but it reminds me of what so many people have said, including you. You said Rilke is what poetry means. The Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva wrote to Rilke a century ago, and she said, "You are not the poet I love most," most implying a comparison. She said, "You are poetry itself." And the birds, the reflection on the nest, the sky, the bird's relationship to its own heart and the world's, it begins to sound like what you're saying.
I think your metaphor that you used about the currency he's dealing in is a really great one, because what he does is he revalues all the values. He is not dealing in the same sort of currency that we're used to dealing in. He deals with poetry. There's another short piece he has called On the Poet's Material That's my title for it. It's from a letter, so he didn't have a title for it.
Please read it.
So I'm just going to read part of it. No one would think to elbow a carpenter, a cobbler, or a cooper away from his craft out into the world, quote unquote, so that he might be a better carpenter, cobbler, or cooper. Musicians, painters, and sculptors, too, are mostly left alone with their work. Only with someone whose work is writing does the craft, the manual labor, seem so negligible, so mastered in advance. Everyone can write. That people think he would immediately descend into empty game-playing if left too much alone with his occupation. But what a mistake! To be able to write is, God knows, no less heavy labor, especially since, and this is getting to the issue of currency, Chris, especially since the raw material of the other arts comes already dissociated from daily use, while the poet's task includes a strange additional duty, that of differentiating his word fundamentally and essentially from the words of mere interaction and communication. No word in a poem, and here I mean every last and the, is the same as the identical sounding word in conversation and ordinary use. The word's pure accordance with the law, its grand interrelations and proportion, the constellation that it occupies in a line of poetry or piece of artistic prose, changes it down to the core of its nature and makes it useless, unusable for mere interaction, makes it untouchable and lasting. And so that's why it's hard to feel what currency he's dealing with, because he sees it as the task of poetry to take language, to take all these words and ideas and remove them from the mere exchange of currency and the mere exchange of ideas that, you know, is our bread and butter in the ordinary world. He's transposing it into this higher or more inner realm. And he's not just talking about it. He's able to do it.
The poet Robert Haas writes that Rilke induces a kind of trance as soon as the whispering begins. And I just want to say gratefully that I experienced it myself. A few weekends ago, sitting before a fire, nursing a cold and reading Rilke, and suddenly that magic spell kicked in. The particular lines that grabbed me were from what you call Notes on the Melody of Things, and it goes like this. There are, in fact, moments when a person stands out from his grandeur in clarity and silence before you. These are rare, festive pleasures that you never forget. You love this person from then on. In other words, you work to retrace with your own tender hands the outline of the personality that you came to know in this hour. And then he goes on. He says, art does the same thing, for art is a farther-reaching, more immodest love. It is God's love. It cannot stop with an individual who is only the portal of life itself. It must move through that individual. It cannot tire. To fulfill its destiny, it has to appear where everyone is a someone. Then it bestows its gifts on this someone, and boundless riches come over everyone. And again,
that's a beautiful passage. It's a wonderful one to respond to as exemplary, as saying what the book as a whole or what Rilke as a whole is doing. One of the just amazing things about Rilke is that everywhere in all these little parts in all of this quite extensive output of poetry, he always seems to be sort of coming from the same place or saying the same thing or something like that. Which is, you know, what he's talking about. He talks about this implantation into you that then spreads out into the world. It's wonderful.
Fascinates me that, as you say, he's always dealing the same cards, in a way, over and over again. But there's this mystery of, again, what currency? Is this psychology? Is this religion? Is it politics? Is it aesthetics? It's a little bit of everything. But the words have their own buzz and beauty and belief all in them.
The thing that makes me think of, Chris, is the angels of the famous Duino elegies. So as though all of his works weren't enough, his life also is the absolute epitome of what we think of as poetry. The famous story is that he was wandering around on this windswept cliffside road by Duino Castle, pacing back and forth because he had an annoying business letter he had to respond to, and then suddenly hears a voice from above, from the sea, who knows, saying, "Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the angels' hierarchies? And even if one of them pressed me suddenly against his heart, I would be consumed." And then he went back inside and answered his letter, and then put the letter aside and wrote the first of what would be the 10 Duino elegies. So the Duino elegies are about these figures of angels that, just like you were saying, are spread across or through all these different realms. Are they religion? Are they psychology? Are they history? Are they love between two people? I was looking back over what he says the angels are, and this is from the second Duino elegy. This is, again, Stephen Mitchell translation, although I'm altering it a little bit. So he says, "Who are you?" about the angels. "Early successes, creation's pampered favorites, mountain ranges, peaks glowing red in the dawn of all beginning, pollen of the flowering Godhead, joints of pure light, corridors, stairways, thrones, skies of being, shields of ecstasy, storms of emotion whirled into rapture and suddenly alone, mirrors which scoop up the beauty that has streamed from their faces and gather it back into themselves entire."
The Duino elegies, of course, are the great work of his last decades. Would you back way up, Damien, to Prague in 1875 and tell us roughly the story of who this man was?
Sure. The interesting thing, really, about his story is that it almost feels irrelevant. Rilke for poetry is kind of like Proust, I think, for novels, where, sure, he has a story. You can place him in the context of the First World War or modernism or symbolism or whatever you want. But that's not really how people talk about him or feel about him. If you ask someone about Proust, they'll talk about the character that they feel that they're most like, or how old they were when they read it, or the feelings that they have about it. I mean, How Proust Can Change Your Life is that book by Alain de Botton. And the reason he picked Proust, I think, is because Proust has sort of stepped out of his life story and just become this Mount Everest, just become this pinnacle of not just what the novel is historically, but what it can be for you as a reader. And I think Rilke has the same feeling. It almost doesn't matter when he was born and died and where he lived, because he writes these lines like, "You must change your life." But he does have a story, of course. He was born in 1875 in Prague, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So like Kafka, he was not Czech because the Czech Republic didn't exist and because he was raised in a German-speaking family. But he was physically in Prague, which he never much liked and found to be provincial and left as soon as he could. He traveled around Europe. The most probably important fixed place he lived was in Paris in the first decade of the 20th century, when he was working as a secretary for the great sculptor Rodin and learning how to make things concrete and physical, which I hope you can hear in the poems I've read, his poetry really does. So he learned that from Rodin. He had written a lot of books of poetry beforehand that have the Rilke music, which in German is just absolutely perfect. But it was a little bit too easy for him, I think, before he had the sort of period of discipline of working with Rodin and getting his hands stuck in cement, as it were, and then crafting these lasting artifacts. The Archaic Torso of Apollo poem for example, is from that period when he had been working with Rodin and, of course, is about a statue. So 1875 is just before the main people who would turn out to be modernists. So, for example, Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, born in 1881, people like Faulkner and Nabokov in the late 1890s, that comes later. The period that we're talking about, 1875 is the year Thomas Mann was born. 1874 is the year that Robert Frost is born. So these are writers who, of course, are central to being modern, but are not yet quite modernist. They are not writers who are shaped quite as much by the chaos and destruction of World War I because they were older before the war came along.
Make the connection, chronologic and otherwise, with Proust, who was born in, what, 1870, I think?
Proust is 1871, so he's slightly older than Rilke. Proust is another one of these figures who who's maximalist in terms of his relationship to the world. He's someone who will investigate and dig into every scrap of aesthetic experience, psychological experience, human interaction, and get down to its underlying truths. So the big difference, I think, between Proust and Rilke is that Proust is much more analytical and Rilke is much more intuitive. Proust is always trying to figure out what it really means and take some situation and uncover the psychological laws that are underneath it. Whereas Rilke is not a systematizer. You know, this is part of what we were talking about before, about how he doesn't have some currency. He doesn't have some theory he's pushing about psychology or religion or what have you. He is just in each new moment and each new poem or letter or whatever it is he's writing, responding and reacting to these perceptions. So you can't get a theory out of Rilke.
Damien, come back to this matter of his setting in time and place, which you say may not matter at all. And yet it's so interesting. He was very happy to be adopted by a number of aristocratic or other interesting women as his sort of muses. And he was also connected sometimes through them, Lou Salome especially, to the great men. I mean, he visited Tolstoy in Russia. Lou Salome had been Nietzsche's mistress before she was Rilke's. Connect him with those giants.
Yeah, so you mentioned Lou Andrea Salome. She was one of the most important people in his life. She's the one who convinced him to go to Italy for the first time. She's the one who got him to change his name from René to Reiner because she thought Reiner sounded more masculine. She is the one who brought him to Russia, got him to learn Russian, introduced him to Tolstoy. And they had an affair for about 2 years when Rilke was in his early 20s. By then, she had already been Nietzsche's lover and would go on to be Freud's close associate, shall we say.
Wow.
And so even though their affair only lasted a short time, they continued to be correspondents for the rest of his life. And she was his sort of most trusted and most valuable mentor. She tried to get him to read Freud, or in fact, meet Freud. And I think it's typical that he said, well, yes, I see why Freud is useful for people who don't live from the spirit, but I live from it, so I don't want to figure it out. I don't want to study it. So in a certain sense, he was culturally very central. He translated a lot of people, including important living French writers. The painter Balthus was a discovery of his. But at the same time, he really did go his own way. He didn't teach. He didn't like to give readings for a large part of his life. He didn't really join any movements or schools or things like that. And as in his relationship with women, I think that in his relationship with other artists, he, other than Rodin, basically was more concerned to preserve his privacy and preserve his personal relationship to the world than he was to gain allies or sort of join in any literary movements of the time or anything like that.
Damien Searles, let's go back to the poetry. I'd like to read the first poem in your wonderful book, The Inner Sky, because like so many others, it has a lot of the magic phrases and themes that he's working all the time. This was written in 1922. He's 47 years old. And it goes like this. As long as you catch what you've thrown yourself, it's all just clever agility and venial gain. But when you suddenly come to catch a ball, an eternal playmate has thrown at you, at your center, has exactly set in mastered motion in an arc out of God's great bridge building, then that you can catch is real power, not yours, the world's. And when you even have the strength and courage to throw it back, no, better yet, have forgotten courage and strength and thrown it back already, the way the year throws birds, the flock of migrating birds hurled over the ocean from an old to a new warmth, then that gamble is the first moment you too can be said to play. You unburden yourself of the throw no longer. You burden yourself with the throw no longer. Out of your hands steps the meteor, and it races into its skies. So many elements there that keep recurring. The birds, the migrating birds, the throw, the tossing and catching of things at play. Sometimes he says more pointedly, you are the masterfully thrown spear. Be spear. Take that apart. They're beautiful words in English, thanks probably to your translation.
Oh, thanks. There's another case where the last word of the poem is this word that in German literally means spaces, but I thought that skies gives you more of that concrete, very visual feeling. I think of that ending, I always think of sort of a special effects movie where Keanu Reeves is standing there and he's holding his hand palm up sort of impassively, and then suddenly this glowing orange ball appears and sort of hums in Dolby surround sound and then whooshes up into the sky. You know, that's the kind of sublime image that this poem has for me, that it's not just somebody tossing a tennis ball up and down or even playing catch with a friend. It's receiving something from this much higher force. Mm. And if you receive it, then you're able to throw it back without even thinking about it. You don't even dare to do it. It just emanates out from you and rockets like a meteor into the sky by itself. It's its skies. It's not even ours.
Mm. As we say, so many linked themes here, Damien, consciousness, art, angels, birds, animals. But there are always these young girls recurring too, a little bit like Proust's girls dancing on the beach at Baalbek. Rilke refers to them as these girls of mine. At play, he says, it's as if they were set on fire by something godlike. There are also village girls at the spinning wheel, simple figures but descended from queens, he writes. Who are Rilke's girls?
Rilke really is fascinating about the relationships between men and women. I think he's able to be so interesting about that because, like so much else for him, they're internal to him. He's really internalized them. He definitely had his inner girl that he treasured, that he protected, that he admired for her innocence and purity and freshness. There's the psychological background to this. He was an only child of unhappy parents who, a year before he was born, had a girl who died after a couple weeks. Mm. And so when he was born, he was the replacement. And his mother, for example, dressed him in girls' clothes for a lot longer than was customary and used to call him by a girl's name and make him pretend to be her daughter. So there's the sort of psychological explanation, but I wouldn't want to reduce it to that. I think that he projects onto girls and also even to some extent women this sense of receptivity that's so important to him as an artist. We were talking about in the poem about throwing and catching or even being thrown, that it's not for Rilke about living by the will and deciding to go out and do something and then you act it out. It's about waiting and receiving the gift that comes to you in the form of this perception. So I think that the girls for him are innocence and purity and also the ability to love.
Damien Searles, I'm dying to ask you to summarize, if you can, what he's saying about art. His writing about it cannot be reduced. In fact, it's just the opposite. It keeps expanding in its possibilities and its meanings. I want to read you just one little fragment. But this struck me as a comment not only about art, but about love and psychology of people, but also it's a commentary, as I read it, on American foreign policy in the year 2010 about how we connect with other people, other countries, and what fashion. This is from what you call the Notes on the Melody of Things, and this is item number 11. He writes, "Art has accomplished nothing except to show us the confusion in which we already find ourselves most of the time. It has frightened us rather than making us quiet and peaceful. It has shown us that we all live on different islands. Only the islands are not far enough apart for us to stay solitary and untroubled. Someone on one island can pester someone on another, or terrorize him, or hunt him with spears. The only thing no one can do to anyone else is help him." What a complex chain of thinking there. What's he saying?
Well, you're asking me a very difficult question, Chris, because he's not ultimately a theorist or a commenter. He sort of doesn't have a doctrine that he's peddling about what art is or what life is or what God is or anything like that. He just has this way of doing something to you when you read him and activating certain feelings that you have, often even unspoken or non-linguistic feelings of intimacy or solitude or what it's like to be in this world around you. So when you're asking me to give you the Rilke line on what art is, it's a pretty tough task. I can say some things to circle around it a bit. And I'd say the main one is this idea of receptivity, that it's not a project. Art isn't something that you decide, oh, I want to be a writer, and then you figure out what to write about, and then you work on it and draft it, and then you write it. That's just not how he sees it. He sees it as much more of this calling or even involuntary response, this sensitivity to things.
Damien Searles, Rilke's poetry is full of angels, famously, but also of God. He comes from a traditional Christian background, but he's not surely a traditional Christian. What has he decided about God?
I don't really see him as saying much about God as a single unitary spiritual source, but I see him as very much concerned with how divine forces or sort of greater things affect us and how we respond to them. The famous opening of the Duino Elegies, "Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the angels' hierarchies? And even if one of them pressed me suddenly against his heart, I would be consumed." That's actually saying not only I can't connect to the angels, but also even if I did connect to them, I'd just go up in a puff of smoke because they're too big, they're too powerful, they're too terrifying. That's one way that, for me, Rilke is very modern, not in the sense of modernist, but just in the sense of modern-day life, where, like many of us today, he's not in a very stable, nurturing, religious structure that gives him all the answers. He's questing and exploring and trying to figure out his own relationship to God and other ways of looking at the divine forces. And that's very exciting and I feel relevant to me as a reader today. You know, I'm not someone who's grounded in a structured religious tradition either. So any inklings that I get of the divine are things that I have to figure out what to do with on my own.
Damien Searles, what can you tell us about the Duino elegies except to read them, which I have? They're all over the place. 10 elegies written over a great span of years or dictated to him. I have a general question about them, but what do we have to know about them first?
Well, the Duino elegies were what Rilke certainly saw as his life work. And I mentioned the story earlier about how the beginning of them came to him, and he certainly did feel that they were just dictated to him. So this was in 1911, 1912 that he wrote the first few, and then he got stuck. And a lot of the stuff that we talked about earlier, how For Rilke, Art is Waiting, came out of the fact that he spent the next 10 years of his relatively short life. He died at 51. He spent 10 years waiting for what he knew would be the rest of the elegies, but he couldn't write them. As he saw it, he had been given the beginning of the Duino elegies, and then he just had to wait until the end came to him. And that's what he spent the next decade doing, trying to prepare himself and ready himself for the arrival of what would be the second half of the Duino elegies. The amazing thing is that he did it, that it happened. So in this quite miraculous 3-week span of time in February of 1922, he wrote the second half of the Duino elegies and, as a little bonus extra, Sonnets to Orpheus, an entire other book, which is the other major late poetry, all in 3 weeks after having been blocked for 10 years waiting for it to come.
I want to ask one very general question about all the elegies as elegies. I mean, we associate that word with laments and memorials and written in mourning, this kind of thing. But on my reading of William Gass's translation, the surprise is that these elegies turn out to be, so many of them, praise songs. One little example from the 9th or 10th, he writes, "Our heart dwells between hammers like the tongue between the teeth, where it remains, notwithstanding, a continual creator of praise." At another point, he says, "Tell us, poet, what do you do? I praise." There is a life worship in these sad poems.
Absolutely. And I have to add just one passage from the 9th elegy. This is again Stephen Mitchell's translation. "Praise this world to the angel, not the unsayable one. You can't impress him with glorious emotion. In the universe where he feels more powerfully, you're a novice. So show him something simple, which formed over generations lives as our own, near our hand and within our gaze. Tell him of things." That's this great move that Rilke's always doing of bringing it back from this very abstract, mystical level to this concrete, poetic image. The next line is, "He will stand astonished as you stood by the rope maker in Rome or the potter along the Nile." So he's always bringing it back to the world, you know, the concrete physical world that we live in. There's a great passage in a prose piece from The Inner Sky called Interiors that's about this as well. "Old people from the country talk about how in the good old days that they call theirs, young girls went to their distaffs in the long afternoons of autumn. In the big, hospitable living room where all their friends would gather together on their very best behavior, they sat contemplatively in a circle, and the early fire cozily stretched out on the imposing wood in the covered tile fireplace often did their talking for them. A smell of fine white linen, homemade raisin cookies from a secret recipe, and hot crackling pine resin, all mixed together, solicitously diffused around my kind-hearted old Aunt Janey would probably be able to bring back to this wonderful ancient woman's mind some of what she felt 45 years before in this same suggestive environment. But we have not the means to draw forth this wondrous scent from its censer, and my kind-hearted Aunt Janey assures me that everything beautiful she brooded about back then must be safe in the threads of the white fabric she keeps, stored all year long untouched in the dull mahogany wardrobe. Since it was not to be found in her own long life, it must have stayed in the tablecloths, she says.
Wow, talk about concrete things.
It's wonderful, right? And the passage even starts with that the fire is cozily stretched out on the wood, so it personifies the fire, and that the fire often did their talking for them. And then the passage ends how the fabrics in the mahogany wardrobe does the talking for them too. So it's not just we who absorb and then are able to give back all these perceptions and sensations from the world. It's that everything in the world is like that too. You know, the tree, or in this case, the fabric. He talks a lot about lace, how lace is the life and soul of these lace makers who worked on the craft of it for so many years at a time. It's how he talks about his poetry too, that he's able to implant these psychological or spiritual feelings into objects. And not only he's able to do it, but just that naturally that's how it works.
Mm. From the notes on the melody of things, Damien, here's another little fragment that sounds like doctrine. Could be, again, about psychology or religion or cosmology or something. He's talking about, as he often does, about foreground and background, the tree against the sky. But I'm also thinking of music, choral music, concerti, jazz. Listen to this. It has an almost religious importance, this seeing, this recognition that the moment you have found the melody of the background, you are no longer helpless in your words and vague in your decisions. He's talking about the soloist, in a sense, against the orchestra, or he's talking about man in the universe. He goes on, all conflict, all error comes from the fact that people look for what they have in common in themselves, not in the things behind them, in the light, in the landscape, in the beginning, and in death. They lose themselves and gain nothing in return. And what did you mean by that, Mr. Rilke?
It's a beautiful passage, and I think you're right that this is that we're getting close to a doctrine here. We're getting close to a real message about what it means to be yourself. It sounds a lot like Emerson, doesn't it?
Yes.
That you have to not just join the choir, but instead be your own individual voice. And then only if you are your own individual voice are you an interesting and relevant part of the choir. But unlike Emerson, there's this background. I don't think Emerson would talk about the commonality of the things behind all the individuals.
You're right. Emerson says, follow the gleam in your own mind from within, which is a little different.
It's very different, even though it's hard to put your finger on what the difference is, right? What does it mean to take your inner sky and fling it out past the tree? It's very concrete as an image. You can sort of feel yourself doing it, but it's hard to say what that means. Whereas Emerson, you know, follow your own inner spark. We kind of all know what that feels like. Even if we can't paraphrase it exactly, it's something that, especially as Americans, we've heard drummed into us about following the beat of a different drummer, which is a Thoreau line, of course. And this is a lot more mysterious. A little bit later in the same piece, a slightly later fragment, he says, we're like fruits. We hang high on strangely jagged branches and suffer many winds. What we possess is our ripeness and sweetness and beauty, but the power to attain these possessions courses into us all through one trunk, from a broad root stretching across whole worlds. If we would bear witness to its power, we must use that power, every one of us, in our most individual solitary sense. Mm. The more solitary people there are, the more solemn and moving and powerful their commonality. Mm. So maybe that's a way to put your finger on the difference with Emerson. Emerson doesn't talk as much about how all of our individualities come from a common source. And he also doesn't really emphasize that the point of individuality is to be able to rejoin commonality in a solemn and moving and powerful way. I mean, he talks about how the self-reliant artist goes into himself, and that's why other people are interested in him as an artist. Mm-hmm. But it's a relationship in the end of the genius to his audience. He doesn't really talk about multiple self-reliant people forming a solemn commonality. And I think Rilke is still very movingly invested in that. It's not really about him. He's this pinnacle for so many of his readers, but he's not ultimately trying to stand apart from the world. He's trying to bear witness to it, as he says in this quote, and have the whole world's power go up through the trunk so that he can be one of the ripe, sweet fruits on the branches.
Damien, you say it so well. There's no summing up Rilke's poetry or his thinking. The main thing, I suppose, is that your book, The Inner Sky, has made me a Rilke reader for the rest of my life, for sure.
But that's wonderful.
Guide me. What am I looking for? What are we all looking for as we get to know this man?
You're looking for what you like. I mean, that's why we read, and that's what he's so good at. I think that it's what worked for me, and I think that really the only other person I can think of like this is Walt Whitman, who for so many people, myself included, is just an invitation, is just someone who welcomes you in, and rather than intimidating you with his big ideas and, you know, I'm a poetic genius, superpowers. Instead, you read him and you like it and you want to read more of it. So I think Rilke is like what he describes the angels as being. The passage I read from the second elegy, early successes, creation's pampered favorites, mountain ranges, peaks glowing red in the dawn. I love that it's this abstract description of, you know, being a favorite or being a success, and then boom, it's a mountain range, pink in the dawn, you see it there, it's towering over you, and you feel the sort of awe that he was telling us about, but then he shows it to us with this image. I feel like that's Rilke.
Damien Searles, it's such a pleasure, and we've loved these conversations on Thoreau, and now on Rilke. We're waiting for your next discovery.
Well, thanks, Chris. It's such a treat to talk with you about both Thoreau and Rilke. Thanks so much.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.